We're starting with our speaker is Tanya Ryder. She has a bachelor's degree in history from University of Utah. She's a lifelong resident of Salt Lake City, and she has worked in education, operated in an art gallery, and been an interior designer. And she says, while searching for my great-grandmother's origins, I discovered my mother's unknown ethnic heritage and learned about a part of early Utah history I had known nothing about. So I think we'll all find this interesting, and let's welcome Tanya.
Thanks. And that's Flady. Growing up in Salt Lake in the early 1960s and the late 1950s, I considered...
Can that be turned on? It's not on.
How's that? Does that make any difference?
No.
That's the only thing I can see on there. Should we ask somebody?
Ask someone first.
There's nothing. Is there like some main switch?
Or if we can just want to raise.
Mm-mm. You might need to ask someone. Should I just wait?
I'm going down.
Sure. Okay. You can hear and take the right here. I'll just wait on that one if she comes back. Okay, I considered myself to be pretty much like all of my friends. I lived amongst middle-class white Mormons, many of whom had similar ethnic backgrounds to mine. Utah's full of the descendants of early LDS, Scandinavian, and English converts with a good measure of other Nordic European lines thrown into the mix. I felt like one of the crowd with my blonde hair and blue eyes. Used to be blonde. I understood my father's family to be mostly English and German, and thought my mother's family was primarily Danish. I'd love to ask my maternal grandmother, Millie, to tell me stories about when she was a little girl living on a ranch near Thistle. Millie was number 7 of a family of 9 children, 8 of whom grew to maturity. I really thought it was funny when she told me she and her sisters didn't have dolls to play with, so they dressed up piglets in baby clothes and pushed them around in an old baby buggy. I could always remember what year she was born because it was 1900. It all seemed so long ago and exotic compared to my suburban life in Salt Lake. While my father's family was LDS, Grandma Millie told me she'd never been baptized into any church. I thought this was a little bit strange and it worried me some, but she said none of her siblings had been baptized as children either. Her husband, my maternal grandfather, had died at a very young age from peritonitis, leaving Millie alone to raise my 3-year-old mother and her 15-year-old sister. Nanny, as we called Millie, told me when her husband was gravely ill shortly before he died, he described the beautiful flowers and the music that he could hear. She said he was seeing a preview of heaven. So I knew, baptized or not, she believed in heaven. Millie's father, a Dane, who was known as Chris Morrison after his arrival in America, had come to Utah sometime in the mid-1800s with his mother and a brother. Nanny told me he came from the LDS Church, and his brother's family had remained in the church. Nanny's mother, Flady, the picture I've passed out to you is Flady, was more of a mystery to me. While Nanny told me she didn't know what her mother's religious background was, my own mother told stories of her grandmother Flady reading from the Bible to her when she was a child, so I thought she must have been a believer. I was told she'd been raised as a Methodist. To make it even more complicated, Nanny said Flady's last name was Ainge, but that was because she had been adopted by the Ainge family. She wasn't biologically an Ainge. I really couldn't figure out what her background had been. Well, Nanny died in 1984, but by that time I thought I knew quite a bit about her family. I had known all of her brothers and sisters to some degree, and the extended family was close and got together often during my childhood. No one in my mother's family seemed interested in writing family histories, and since most of them were not LDS, they hadn't filled out any 4-generation pedigree charts either. As an adult, I only had what I could remember hearing from them to try to piece together a picture of their past. During the Christmas season, early in the
2000, while visiting Temple Square to look at the light display, I went inside the visitor center to warm up and saw they had installed computers for genealogical research. I'd never tried that before, so I sat down and I put in the name Lady H. It came up with a pedigree that listed a mother and maternal grandparents, but where the name of her father should have been, it said unknown. Well, it was like a light switched on in my head, and things began to make sense. Her mother's last name was Ainge. My great-grandmother's lady was a biological Ainge. She was just illegitimate. Had my grandma Millie known that the whole time, and she was just too embarrassed to tell me? I decided it couldn't be that hard to figure out whose lady's father had been. So I determined to start researching. The next few months, I became obsessed with the question. Every spare minute I could devote to following a new line of inquiry, I was at the Family History Library, or the DDP, or the State Archives. I found a whole lot of information about my mother's family that seemed to be completely unknown.
We can't get it to turn
microphone?
On.
Uh-huh.
I tested these. Check.
Hold yeah. Okay.
Anyway, I found out a whole lot of information about my mother's family that seems to be completely unknown to everyone in the last couple of generations. My mother, who converted to Mormonism as an adult, had actually had four LDS grandparents, pioneer grandparents. Some of her ancestors had been in Kirtland and Nauvoo, so why had this strong LDS heritage been forgotten? It was apparent that for various reasons, by the turn of the 20th century, the members of the family from whom she was descended had become disaffected. I felt like I came from a long
line. One, two, three.
That's working. Okay.
Should I just start in where I am in the hut? We'll just go from there.
Still, with all the information coming to light, I knew nothing of Lady Ainge's father. I had been able to find out that her mother, Love Ainge, had come from rural England with her father, George, mother, Elizabeth, and siblings. They had settled in Spanish Fork, Utah County in the 1860s. They had all converted to Mormonism in England, and Love's oldest brother had led the way to Utah. Upon arriving in Utah, Love began calling herself Emma and went by that name, or a combination of both names, for the rest of her life. Emma gave birth to Flady in 1864 and then had a baby boy named John in 1866. She later married John Harris, another English convert, as a polygamous second wife in 1874. They were sealed in the endowment house and subsequently had four children together. I'm going to show you this picture.
This is that family. This is Emma, her husband, John Harris, and the four kids.
He looks so old in that picture, and she looks really tired. Strangely, after she married John Harris, Emma, or at least I knew that Flady and John had gone back to Spanish Fork to be raised by her parents while she and John Harris lived in Pleasant Grove. My great-grandmother was only 10 years old, and her little brother was only 8 when Emma married her new husband. And they never lived with her after that. After months of frustration due to finding nothing in the search for Flady's paternity, one of the genealogists at the LDS Family History Library suggested that looking at a census could be helpful. Having no genealogical training, I hadn't thought of such a simple answer. Of course, I should try that. I asked about how to find and access the 1870 Utah listings in the U.S. Census records. One of the older sister missionaries trotted me over to the index book, and we looked up the name of Ainge. There on the page were the names of Emma Ainge and her two children, Flady and John. There was no man's name listed as part of the household, except Emma's father and brother's names. Next to each of the children's names, there was the letter M. The missionary looked at the listing, then she let out a little gasp, seemed to get the vapors a little bit, and said, oh my, there's an M by your great-grandmother's name. Well, I saw it too, but I didn't know what it meant. Oh dear, she said, that means mulatto. So at this point, I said, well, it could have been. I don't know who the father was. He very well could have been someone who was black. she looked at me and she said, "But your eyes are blue." I said, "Well, that's what happens when you intermarry with Danes for several generations." The first thing I did when I left the library that day was call my sister, who knew that I was on this search, and ask her if she ever wondered where her very curly hair had come from. Her first answer was, "We're Jewish?" I said, "No, guess again. We're black?" So before that day, I would have said I had no racial prejudices. Surely I was happy in 1978 when the priesthood ban was lifted and blacks of African descent could enjoy all the rights and privileges in the LDS Church they'd been denied for so long. But those people were not really my people. I'd never had an African-American friend, and I really didn't even know there were any black people in Spanish Fork in the 1860s, let alone one that could have been my great-great-grandfather. And as for slavery, the closest I got to that subject was my junior high obsession with Gone with the Wind. I believed slavery was an evil system, but its practice in the antebellum South never touched my life. Despite earning a BA in history, I'd managed to graduate with very little knowledge of life in the American South, and I knew absolutely nothing about Africa. I had no clue that slavery was even legal in Utah, or that there were LDS converts who brought their slaves with them across the plains. Or, more correctly, the slaves brought them across the plains, since they were always the ones driving the wagons. Learning that there were black Mormons in early Utah was eye-opening, but it didn't compare to finding out I was descended from one of them. I don't want to sound overly dramatic about the effect discovering this little piece of my family puzzle had on me, but having a mixed race background had never had any direct impact on my day-to-day life. Discovering it, though, made me more aware of other people's lives in a way that I hadn't been before. I suddenly wanted to know what it might have been like to live under slavery, or what it was like to be mixed race in 19th century rural Utah. My perspectives were slightly changing. I began to develop a little bit of empathy for people I had thought were completely other. I began to realign my view of who I had always thought I was to fit who I now knew I really was. Suddenly, they weren't they anymore. They had become we. Knowing that I was looking for a black man who was living in Utah in the early 1860s significantly narrowed the pool of candidates, but it also begged many other questions. I assumed the man I was searching for was probably mixed race himself because Flady had successfully passed as white all her adult life. You saw her picture. I mean, you really wouldn't see that she was mixed. How in the world had the father of my great-grandmother and her brother had a relationship with a white English convert? How had that happened in Spanish Fork in 1863? How had she had been involved with him long enough to have had not one, but two children with him? How many African Americans were even in the area during that time? This had all happened in Utah County at a time when, technically, interracial marriage was legal, but socially and religiously unacceptable. Emma and the children had managed to stay and live a good part of their lives in that area, despite what must have been very difficult circumstances. What had been the consequences of Emma's actions on the trajectories of Flady and John Ainge's lives? I found that a life sketch of Emma Ainge had been submitted to the Daughters of Utah Pioneers. It was written early enough that the author still knew something about the father of Emma's first biracial children. As it turned out, the history was written by one of Emma's husband's descendants from his first marriage, strangely enough. In it, the father of Flady and John was labeled, quote, a southern man, quote unquote, and it said she had lived with him and that they had had two children together. It also said the father had left some property for the maintenance of the kids. I wasn't sure what that meant, if he deeded to them while living or bequeathed it to them, but it did show that he was a property owner. Next, I ran across a little DUP publication from 1965 called The Story of the Negro Pioneer. It was put together from reminiscences by DUP members about early Mormon African Americans and their white masters. It became my starting point to try and get information about this segment of the early Utah population. I discovered there were LDS converts from Mississippi and North Carolina and other southern states who were slaveholders in the South and continued to be slaveholders in the West. In some cases, when the white family was baptized, some of the slaves were baptized as well. Even after emancipation came, many of the slave families made the Intermountain West their homes, and descendants of these early black settlers continued to be part of modern-day Utah. While some of the slave families had been Mormon in the early days, most of the progeny was no longer affiliated with the LDS Church. I really didn't know if I was looking for a slave or a free black, so I researched all the families and people I could find any information on at all. I heard the story of Jane Manning James and her family, as well as the histories of Elijah Abel and Green Flake. Some of these men and women had roots in the LDS faith that went as far back as Nauvoo. They had contributed to the growth of the church since the beginning, and they had been there on the trek to Utah, helping the saints establish their home in the West. Some had come from the eastern U.S. as well as the South. I read about the Perkins family in Bountiful, the farms in East Mill Creek owned by African-American Mormons, and the black settlers in Fort Union. I visited their graves and sought out their descendants to see if I could find a clue to my own past. I looked up the Utah slave schedules and early censuses to try to put together a picture of who everyone was and where they lived. I read the family histories of the white families who owned the slaves, hoping there would be clues there. Someone told me to try and trace the lives of women in the past is difficult, for obvious reasons. Men usually conducted the business of the past. I have to say, if it's hard to discover the lives of ordinary women, it's even harder to try to put together the story of American slaves. Unless their lives crossed white lives in some significant way, they were largely undocumented. Ronald Coleman's thesis was helpful, as were articles by Newell Bringhurst, Armin Maas, and other scholars who had written about early Utah and the position of blacks and minorities in the LDS Church in the past. When Darius Gray and Margaret Young published their series of novels, I Ate Them Up, the Standing on the Promises books, despite being fiction, were well-researched and put flesh on the bones of these people I was beginning to know. The books made their lives more real to me. There was a family I learned about in my research who had originally lived in the South but migrated to Utah in 1850. The John Hardison Red family moved from coastal North Carolina to a plantation near Murfreesboro, I can never say this right, Murfreesboro, Tennessee. John Hardison's wife, Elizabeth Hancock Red, had brought two slave women with her into the marriage. These women seemed to have been personal servants, waiting on her and helping with the housework more than field work. When the family was converted to Mormonism by Elder John D. Lee in 1843, not only were the white members of the family baptized, so were Elizabeth's servants, Venus and Cheney. Shortly after his conversion, John Hardison sold the Tennessee plantation in preparation to gather to Zion, and the family immigrated to Utah with the James Pace Company. What interested me about the Red story was that when Venus and Cheney came out west with the Red family, they brought four younger slaves with them. Red family histories insist that these six servants had been freed and chose to come to Utah. However, there are other indications that they were not, in fact, free. In any case, there were probably multiple reasons for the black Reds to accompany the white Reds to Utah. At the risk of sounding like I subscribe to the Magnolia myth train of thought, life in the West with a family they knew could have been a more attractive prospect than staying in Tennessee. Life for manumitted slaves in a slave state was not an easy life if they had been freed. It could be dangerous and restrictive. If they were treated well by the Red family, it seems to have, as has seems to have been the case, Venus and Cheney might have preferred to stay with the family if they were truly given a choice. There was also the added incentive of their membership in the LDS Church. They could have wanted to join the saints in the Rocky Mountains. While it wasn't necessarily a free life, it might have been a more secure life. Lack of evidence proving their manumission suggests that they really didn't have a choice anyway. The young people who traveled west with the Reds were identified in later family histories as the children of the black women. Luke and Sam are said to be Venus's boys, and Mirinda and Amy, the girls, belong to Cheney. There's some discrepancy between the 1850 census and the birth dates given for the children, because all of the censuses with the information about the black slaves are very, their ages change constantly. But Luke was probably about 22 when they arrived in Utah. 20-year-old Sam disappeared from the written record soon after the family settled in Spanish Fork. But Luke shows up in the 1870 census, and there are stories about him in Red family histories that show he stayed connected with the family until sometime in the 1870s. Knowing Luke was in Spanish Fork during the 1860s made him a prime candidate to be Flady and John's father. It didn't seem all that simple to me, though. I discovered that Luke had been given to John Hardison Red's oldest son, Lemuel. And Lemuel had moved to New Harmony in 1862, which is over 200 miles from Spanish Fork, and Luke helped him to move down there. The stories say Luke stayed close to Lemuel and ran a barbershop there. He appears in the 1870 census in New Harmony. Still, so many things seem to point to him. For one thing, he and all the other young red slaves show up in the censuses as yellow or mulatto. It made sense that it would be easier for Flady to pass into white society as an adult if she were a quadroon, to use the old-fashioned expression. In addition, he had been living in Spanish Fork for at least part of the mid-1860s, and New Harmony was not so far that he couldn't make the trip back and forth. There really was no proof that he made a permanent home in New Harmony until after John's birth in 1866, and Luke had owned property. He was a southern man, and he fit the description in the DUP life sketch, and he was single. There were a few hints at his personality in the Red family histories that indicated he might not have easily accepted his secondary status in assigned to blacks in 19th century Utah. Few negative traits get talked about in Mormon faith-promoting family histories. You have to read between the lines sometimes to get a sense of what is really being conveyed. In one description of Luke, one of the Reds says that he was a help to the family, but he sometimes got in trouble when he was called a nigger and needed their backing. Another story is told about a time in the 1870s when one of the young Red wives is cooking and stirring a big pot of mush for the family. Luke came up behind her and slipped an arm around her waist. She pulled out the spoon out of the hot mush pot and smacked him in the face with it to tell him that she wasn't game for that kind of thing. But it made me wonder why he thought his advances toward a white woman might be welcomed. Was it because this wasn't the first time he tried something like that? Marie Taylor, a genealogist at the LDS Family History Library, insisted that Luke was the man I was looking for. Without any definitive proof, I just wouldn't believe her. I rejected the notion that it could be the closest guy. Proximity just seemed too convenient. I went so far afield as to look for a black soldier stationed at Camp Floyd to find Flady's father. I should have listened to Marie. Marie had studied the early black Mormons for years, discovering and documenting research records that had been forgotten by most LDS genealogists. She had a remarkable experience when she'd undergone brain surgery for the removal of a tumor. It was necessary for her to relearn everything after the surgery. She had to learn how to walk and talk and feed herself, but she retained her knowledge of the black pioneers. She was a big help to me in my research and a source of encouragement. I expected to put the pieces together immediately and know who my great-great-grandfather had been in a matter of a few weeks. She told me I had plenty of time and to be patient. It might be years before I'd know. Well, patience is not one of my virtues, and after not turning up any leads after several years of search, I lost enthusiasm for my research. I resigned myself to accepting the fact that I might never know the identity of my great-great-grandfather. During the intervening years between my first attempts to understand Flady's story and the present, I occasionally looked at Family Search or read something about early black Utah history, but mostly I did other things. That is, until the spring of 2014, when after working on some of my husband's family lines, I thought I'd take a peek at my mother's line again. I didn't see anything new, but when I looked at Luke Red's page in Family Tree, there were some changes. In conjunction with restoring the Pioneer Heritage Cemetery in Spanish Fork, there had been awakened interest in the Spanish Fork residents who might have been buried there. Luke's mother, Venus, they thought had died at a time that made it likely she was interred there, along with her former master, John Hardison Red, and his wife. Seeing that an attempt had been made to seal Venus and Luke to John H. Red, I wondered if someone out there knew something that I hadn't found. I felt myself being pulled back slowly into the Luke Red genealogical vortex. Late in June, I looked at my family tree on Family Search and was shocked to see that Luke Red had been added as Flady's father. I hadn't added him, so who had and why? One of the things about Family Search that drives me nuts. Anyway, so one of the Ainge Harris descendants, Emma's second family's descendants, Mike Harris, had found a reference to Luke Red and Emma Ainge in the LDS archives. We had looked there before, and this reference wasn't there, but someone in the intervening years had made an item record and put their name specifically on it. It turns out that another cousin, Debbie Spires, had gone on researching my maternal line, even after I'd gotten discouraged and abandoned it. Mike found a letter written by a Spanish Fork bishop, Albert King Thurber, reporting to George A. Smith the progress of a trial being held in Provo, in which Luke Red and Emma Ainge were accused of, quote, lewdness resulting in her having a child, unquote. The letter, written on June 17, 1864, reports that Emma, on that day, had testified in open court that Luke Red was the father of her baby. Luke had denied it and was scheduled to testify the next day. The trial records are missing. The trial took place 3 weeks after Flady's birth. Mike posted the information almost exactly 150 years after the day the trial began. Emma's testimony was proof enough for me that Luke Ward Red was my great-great-grandfather. It strains credulity to believe that Emma would have stood in open court and lied about a black man being the father of her child. Luke's reaction also seems completely understandable. He was certainly not in an enviable position. I thought knowing the name of Flady's father would satisfy my curiosity about that line, but it just brought out so many other questions. Yes, I was really happy to know this part of the story, and it was gratifying to have that irritating blank filled in on the family tree, but I kept thinking about what we still didn't understand about this family. How, after suffering through the humiliation of a court trial when Flady was born, did this couple go on to have a second child 2 years later? Did they really live together, as reported in the DUP life sketch, or did they only meet from time to time? How did they keep up this forbidden relationship in territorial Utah while Brigham Young was calling for blood atonement for anyone who was involved in a mixing of black and white blood? I knew in the heat of the Mormon Reformation, this was probably mostly inflammatory rhetoric, but it could still make life pretty unbearable for this couple. By 1870, we know from the census that Emma was living with her mother and father at their home in Spanish Fork. Luke was gone. He might have moved on to New Harmony permanently by then. It's not inconceivable that he found it necessary to leave Spanish Fork after John's birth. Again, more unanswered questions come to mind. Members of the community undoubtedly knew something of the story, because the census taker identified both children as mulatto then and in 1880. Given their later histories, I doubt that it was very obvious by skin color or other outward signs that the children were mixed race. But I'm sure knowledge of the trial, at least, had spread. The children were raised in a Mormon household by the Ainge grandparents, and yet I can find no record or indication they were ever given an LDS name blessing or were baptized as children. I don't know if they attended school with the other children of Spanish Fork, but I assume they did. They were both literate. Were they treated well by the small Mormon farming community, or were they shunned because of their parentage? Did they have friends growing up? Did they take part in the life of the LDS ward? How did they cope when their mother were married and they were sent back to live with their grandparents. Why did it happen? The histories say that John Harris's first wife handpicked Emma to be John's plural wife. She knew Emma was English and a single mother. She must have been feeling extremely charitable at the time. After the marriage, Lady and John lived with Emma for a short time, and the new husband visited and helped out with the kids, but within a very limited period, they were back with Emma's parents. Family had speculated that once the marriage took place, the first wife wasn't very happy after all, and she made things unpleasant for Emma and John. Perhaps it was easier, without the added pressure, for John Harris of raising another man's children and keeping two wives happy. Did Flady and John even know who their father was? They were self-identified as white every time they were asked on any type of document as adults. In fact, John called himself John Haynes, which is kind of a variation of Ainge, all his life, possibly because it avoided the embarrassment of using his mother's surname, a sign of his illegitimacy. As an adult, he and his sister both left Spanish Fork, although Flady only went as far as up the canyon, up to Thistle. While Flady stayed in Utah ranching with her husband, John became a miner in Butte, Montana. Like Flady, he too chose a white spouse. The woman John married in Montana in 1909 had been previously married and had children, but she and John didn't have any children together, so there are no cousins from that line to question or test their DNA. John's wife, like Flady's husband, had a Utah Mormon background, but none of them appeared to have had any association with the LDS Church in their later adult life. Many of the questions I had about the life of my great-grandmother and her parents are still unanswered. Without any diaries or written accounts that reflect their thoughts and explain their reasoning, my ancestors have left me unenlightened. The true story of Emma's relationship with Luke was buried deep in the memories of those that were living with her in the late 1860s. It is a pioneer story that doesn't get told over the pulpit on Pioneer Day church talks. If later family members knew anything about it, they thought it best to just eliminate the negative and keep it to themselves. Only mysterious hints filtered through to the present. Emma's life, however, was a remarkable one. Her story may not be the typical goodly parent narrative, nor can it be tied up with a pretty pink bow, but I think it shows she was a strong woman who wasn't afraid to live the way she wanted. Her relationship with Luke says that, but so does her marriage to John Harris. She seems to have made a complete turnaround by 1874. It is incredible that she was able to make that transition successfully and maintain a relationship with her first two mixed-race children. Despite the fact that Flady and John were raised by their grandparents, they seem to have had a close bond with their mother and even her second family. When John was mining in Butte, he wrote letters home to his half-sister, Lizzie Harris, that show he was interested in keeping touch with her. In one of the letters, he offered to send some money home to help Emma pay for false teeth that she needed. He and Flady gave up their land inheritance from their father to support Emma in her last years. Even into the next generation, there was a substantial connection because I remember my grandmother, Millie, complaining because as a young girl, her mother would send her over to clean Aunt Lizzie Harris's house. At least the question of how my mother's family came to have no connection to the LDS Church, despite its deep pioneer roots, seems to be answered. The circumstances of Flady and John's births and the deep taste for miscegenation at that day seem to have forced Emma's first two children in a different direction than her second family took. I suspect they were never completely integrated into the church and community of White Spanish Fork. Looking back 150 years into the past from our present vantage point isn't easy. Today, now that the priesthood restriction is no longer a barrier, it has become more and more common to see middle-class, Nordic-looking Mormons adopting little African-American babies, But that doesn't mean it was cute to have someone of color in your white family in 1864 Utah. Mormons of that day took the Mark of Cain doctrine seriously. It looks to me that Flady knew she was different and removed herself as an adult. Her children took various religious paths, some finding their way back to Mormonism as older adults, some to Catholicism, and some to no church at all. I suspect, though, that none of them ever knew anything about their mother's mixed-race background. All they knew is they had olive complexions that tanned up nicely in the summer sun. If we've been able to trace Luke Red's genealogy. Yes. In fact, I have written a longer scholarly footnoted version of the story of that family, and I've submitted it for publication. I don't know yet if it's going to be publicized. I've submitted it to Utah Historical Quarterly. So it's looking like, since this all happened, I did genetic testing. And the genetic test did show that I had just a small bit of sub-Saharan African genealogy. But when they linked me with my cousins, it linked me with the John Hardison Red family, which then tells us probably that Luke Red was John Hardison's son. So he was the child of the slave woman and the master. Since that time, well, do you have any other questions? I'll answer questions first, then I can go on to the post information. Anybody else have any other questions? Okay, so what happened is after I wrote this, I started trying to discover more about where those children had come from. And many people in the family had really kind of assumed that they were, you know, they were some white man's child, possibly John Hardison's children. But I think the family really, like a lot of white families who've joined the LDS Church, wanted to ignore it. They just pushed it to the side and didn't think a lot about it. And so as I was finding out about my background, I ended up posting on Family Search, finally, this connection, and immediately got a response from the Red family. Now, the Red family, you know, is the...
They're really prominent.
The big Red family, yeah.
They're really prominent in the San Juan...
Uh-huh. They went to San Juan County. It's Bruce Red McConkie. The Mathesons are Reds. They're just all kinds of people that descend from that family. But anyway, so I got a response from one of the Red family members. It was a very nice response, but he wanted to know why I thought this, you know, how I was finding it out, and wanted to engage. So he and I began to correspond, and in the course of the correspondence, he said, well, I guess you know that there's always been a rumor in New Harmony that Luke Red had a child with a woman in New Harmony, a white woman in New Harmony, which I hadn't known anything about. And he said, and that descendant was male, and there are living male descendants. We can test them. And so through a sort of winding course, we found one of those living male descendants, and he said that he would be tested for the Y DNA, which he was, and which showed that he was a Red. So the problem is he has now, he's pulled out of the testing. He's older than I am. He had a completely different experience growing up than I did. So for him, this has been a really troubling discovery, I think. But since that time, now we have contacted his nephew, who is also a direct male-to-male-to-male descendant, and he has volunteered for testing, and he has no problem. So as soon as we get that test done, then we can publish that information. but we really can't until we have his, you know, have his DNA. But just as a sidelight, this guy, the nephew, he grew up in Cedar City, and he is probably in his late 40s. And he told me, I mean, these people have sort of horrifying stories. So do you want to hear that story? So he told me that growing up in Cedar City, he didn't really, none of them, they kind of kept a secret in that family. The rumor was there, but they didn't really investigate it. So what happened was, after Luke had the two children with my great-great-grandmother in Spanish Fork, I think that everyone had had enough of this guy in Spanish Fork. And Lemuel Hardison Red had moved to New Harmony, and I think he probably helped facilitate getting Luke out of Spanish Fork and got him into New Harmony. Got him settled in New Harmony, and he ran a little barbershop down there, did odd jobs and things, but moved in next door to a woman named Mary Ann Pace Goddard. She'd been married to a man who, I guess, was in and out of the insane asylums, and he was gone for a good long period, like 12 years had gone by, and she had teenage boys, and then she had the youngest child was 12 years old. Well, Luke moved in next door. I think these two had been in the same wagon train. So I think they had known each other before. And 1870, I think it's the December of 1872, she has a baby, but there's no husband around. And the story is just a terrible story, but this is the way the rumor goes. The rumor was she hid the pregnancy, she had the baby out in an outbuilding on her property, and just came in the house and left the baby. And one of her children heard a baby crying and found the baby and brought it into the house and presented their mother with, "What's this we just found in the woodshed?" And I guess that she at that point either admitted to them what had happened, but somehow somebody knew that it was Luke's baby. He is out of New Harmony within that, you know, right, either right before the baby's born or right after. He's out of New Harmony and he goes to California. But she, the boys, her sons, just really took to that baby. And they basically raised him, I guess. And they had a herding camp up in the Pine Mountains. They'd take him every summer up to the herding camp with them. And his story is real similar to Flady and John's. I don't think he was ever baptized, and grew up and ended up marrying a woman. They had some kids, and then it was his grandson that we contacted. By that point, the grandson had been raised in the church, but his parents were not really active. And when he got to be 12, he was told he wasn't getting the priesthood, and he didn't know why, because there'd never been any discussion about why. There was just this rumor that, oh, maybe we have some black ancestry. So he didn't find out about it until he was 12. His nephew told me that growing up in Cedar City in the 1970s, I mean, this has to be the 1970s, he also, you know, his family they were LDS, they went to church, but he knew his dad didn't have the priesthood. He didn't know why his dad didn't have it, but he knew he didn't have it. And he said that there was some kind of altercation, different things would happen. He got in a fight with another boy. The father of that boy came over, and he said, "I really kind of remember that he was somebody important in the church, a bishop or something, came over to the house and was trying to tell the parents, you know, you've got to stop fighting with this kid." And it escalated. The parents got involved, and the next thing this kid remembers is the church person yelling at his father, "Well, you dirty niggers don't belong here in Cedar City anyway." And this kid is just like, "What does this mean? I don't even know what this means." He didn't know why they were saying that to him until I called him on the phone a few weeks ago and said, "Here's your family story." So, so anyway, it's kind of a sad, it's just kind of a sad and interesting tale.
Have you found a photo of Luke Red?
No, I don't think there is a photo of him. I do have a photo of his son, And then I have the photo of Flady. And I have a photo of Lemuel Hardison Red, who would be his half-brother. And there are some similarities. The son, Clarence, who was born to the Goddard woman, the son, Clarence, looks a lot like Lemuel Hardison Red. Any other questions?
So, since the Red family is trying to question you on that, are they on board? Are they agree?
Yes. The Red family is a huge, huge family. And they have an organization, like a family organization, and they have sort of a committee that runs the family organization. And somehow, just because of the people that have contacted me, I've gotten in touch with the people on that committee who are just really excited about all this. They've been wonderful. In fact, I went to their reunion last weekend, and it was pretty funny because they wanted to know who you're descended from before they'll let you in. Well, now, who are you descended from? Well, I kept saying, well, it's kind of complicated because right now we want to put this on their website, but we don't want to do it until we can tell the whole story with the DNA. So we're backpedaling a little bit until that point. But the ones who know about it are they're very welcoming. In fact, they are so welcoming that they are considering changing the name of their organization, which is right now the John Hardison Red and Elizabeth Hancock Red Family Organization, to just the John Hardison Red Family Organization. Because there was also an illegitimate child born back in North Carolina before any of his own, legitimate children. And there is another really strange thing that's popping up, which is a Liberian connection. There is a Liberian man who's also being tested, who says he's a Red family descendant. But he may be a descendant from one of the other slaves' families, from one of the other cousins. So he's in the process of being tested.
So Luke's mother, I forgot what her name was.
Emma. Oh, Luke's mother, Venus. Venus.
And have you been able to trace that line?
Actually, yes, a little bit. And that, we didn't think that would happen. But, and all this is in the paper, the other paper that I published. I hope Utah Historical Quarterly, but I won't know for a couple more weeks. Okay, what happened is the Red family had a family member years ago named Laura Red, who was just one of those old women that lived to be nearly 100, never married, and did all the genealogy for the family. And she wrote this big, thick book called The Utah Reds and Their Progenitors. She researched all their lines, and in the book, she copied a notebook that John Hardison Red had carried around with him in Utah in the 1850s. And you know how it is when you copy handwritten little things from the 19th century. They're really, really hard to read. Plus, she shrank it so it would fit in the book. And nobody ever looked at those pages in the book. They just didn't read them. So about, I don't know, it wasn't very long ago, but 2 months ago maybe, one of the Reds, who was welcoming me into the family, had given me the book kindly, and I had it open, and I thought, I should try and read this notebook. This is, it's in the book. I should try and read it. And so I started trying to read it. Most of it was accounts, versions of, I sold so-and-so some lumber for a dollar, and I did this and I did that. And then there was a page that had all these crossed out lines. Like there were things written and then they were lined out, and you could tell that they'd really taken care to line them out horizontally and line them out vertically. So I knew that Venus, we were lucky enough to have a patriarchal blessing for her. And on her patriarchal blessing, it said name of your father and mother, and it said Cupid and Amy were her father and mother. So as I was looking at this lined out section in the notebook, I could read behind the line, I could kind of make out Cupid and Amy. And I thought, these are lists of the slaves. Oddly enough, they are written right in the middle of his family lines. So, for instance, he writes, John Hardison Red married Elizabeth Hancock, and the date, and then a couple more genealogies, and then slaves start and are crossed out, and then he goes back to his children. And the family had never looked at it. They'd never read it. So I called up Dr. Mason Red, Amasa Mason Red, who'd given me the book. And I said, do you happen to know where this notebook is that's reproduced in Laura's book? And he said, well, yes, I do. I have it in the basement. And, I mean, lucky break. He goes in the basement, pulls out the book, because he'd helped his father publish the first edition of the book, and it just put everything in a box. There's John Hardison Red's original notebook sitting in this cardboard box in Mason's basement. So he pulls it out, and I said, can I come over, like, right now? So I went over, and he opened it up, and the actual notebook, the original names are written, like, in a blue ink, and then the crossing outs in a different ink, and it was even easier to read. So we got a magnifying glass and we could read it all. And what he had done is he had listed, it's very strange. We still can't figure it out because I thought, oh, we're going to see it now. It's going to say, Luke read the son of Venus and John Hardison. I thought he's confessed it in the notebook. But no, we didn't see that. He had written the names of his father-in-law's slaves. I know this is kind of complicated, but Venus and Cheney had been inherited by his wife. His wife's father had a couple. They had Cupid and Amy. Cupid and Amy had five children. All those children are listed in this notebook with their birth dates. I mean, do you know how rare this is? It is so rare to find birth dates of slaves and to find parents of slaves. But apparently the Hancocks had this little family group of slaves. And then they gave them, Zebedee Hancock gave them to his children. You know, different ones went to different children. And I have been able to trace one of the other siblings. So that's the next step. The next step is trying to find them. But once you hit that point, beyond that, I mean, I'm back to like, it's about late 1700s. And once you get past that point, there are no names on the slave schedules. They're just ages and sex and color. So it's a little bit hard. Anything else? Okay, thanks you guys. Thanks for coming.
Oh, I was going to ask, how long did all of this take? How many years?
Well, I started about 2002 originally, and then I did it for about 2 years. I think I pretty much dropped things by 2005. And then after it was after I saw the trial letter, the letter about the trial on Family Search, that I started again, which was June of 2014. And it's like everything has just blown wide open in the last year. It's been really kind of incredible. You know, there's a woman in Pennsylvania who is writing, she's basically rewriting the story of the Negro pioneer. And she's finding all kinds of things. It's like early black history, you know, has just kind of exploded in the last 20 years. And in the last few years, even more so. So all sorts of things are coming to light. And that's what happened. This last year, it was just, it's pretty incredible. And to have a whole new family. I have a whole new family now, too, which is really funny, but great. Thanks, you guys.
What am I doing?